Session number 10455, Reel 1.
Mr. Milam, Reel 1. Could you tell me, first of all, Mr. Milam, something about where you were born and your family background?
Well, I was born in a little place called Rolvenden in Kent. My father was a farmer. I went to the village school until I was 11, and I obtained a scholarship and went to Cranbrook School until I was 18.
Is Cranbrook School an independent school?
It's a public school.
And you left to do what?
And I left then. For a while I worked on the farm from the father. And when I was 20, I joined the police.
So how did you come to be in the forces?
I was called up.
What was your reaction when you heard Mr. Chamberlain announce that we were at war with Germany, if you did hear him on the radio?
I didn't hear the actual radio because I was on duty then, but within 2 minutes we had the first air raid alarm. I was at Hastings then.
What was your reaction, though? Had you expected it or not?
Well, we've been expecting it ever since they had issued the gas masks in September 38 in the Czechoslovakian crisis. And we were trained, all the police were trained in civil defence procedures.
Were you shocked? Were you dismayed when you heard that we were at war with Germany? Or?
No, I was expecting it. We had trial blackouts and all that sort of thing. We were building up to it.
Were you just resigned or what? Enthusiastic?
Well, I just thought, well, I'd carry on with the job.
So you never thought of volunteering?
We couldn't. We reserved occupation. We could only, after a while, you could volunteer for flying duties in the Air Force. But I was one who believed in keeping my feet on the ground. But in 1942, de-reserved all policemen who had registered under the age of 25. And we were called up within about a month. And I think there was a great number of us finished up in Burma, because I think that's what they wanted the extra men for.
So you went into the Royal Artillery?
Yes.
What was your initial training like?
Well, we had 6 weeks square bashing in what was then called the General Service Corps. I did that with the Buffs at Canterbury. And then, as the instructions were that we policemen should be treated as volunteers. And so I volunteered for the artillery, and I went on a driving maintenance course down in Wales for 12 weeks.
How did you get out of Burma? How did that come about?
Well, we went, having completed that, we didn't, in the training regiment in Aberystwyth, there was a driver's battery, a gunner's battery, and a specialist battery. And we didn't get together. But then we went up to Rose-on-Sea, where there was a holding regiment, and there was a 12-week course there where we all got together, did schemes, and the 12 weeks included a fortnight's embarkation leave. And then we went up one night, we went up to Gourock, got on a Yankee trooper, It was called the John Ericsson and it had quite a name.
For what?
Well, they didn't put any food on before we sailed, and after 5 weeks, when we got to Cape Town, there was a lot of malnutrition. And we had 6 weeks recuperation leaving Cape Town.
Were you one of the ones who went down?
No, because I was on fatigues in the galley at night.
So you got your share. What was it like in Cape Town?
Well, the point was that we were in a camp outside of Cape Town. The people were very nice, but that when we went down to Cape Town on the train, it was the force's concession price to go to the cinema was 3 and 6 pence, and we were getting about 7 shillings a week, you see. So what we used to do, we used to walk from the camp to Musen, a place called Musenberg. It was only 6 miles, and go to the cinema there for a shilling, you see, and then walk back. But we got invited out to meals and things. People on the street say, well, come home and have something to eat.
These were British, English-speaking people, or
yes,
Dutch-speaking people?
English-speaking, in round about there.
And so, did you have to face any enemy action at all on the way to the Far East?
No, we picked up a boatload of survivors just off Lagos.
When was that? Do you know the date, approximately?
I'm trying to work it out. Well, we sailed about 2 days before the Sicily landings.
That was July 1943?
Yes. So it would have been end of July.
Do you know which ship they'd come from?
No. It was one of the escorts picked them up.
What condition were they in?
Don't know.
Were there many?
A boatload. I don't know how many. They only told us on the boat.
So it was a peaceful journey, really?
Fairly, yes. I think we nearly went to America, because it took us 5 weeks to get from Europe to Cape Town.
And when approximately did you arrive in India?
Well,
about August 1943?
I think I can tell you. We went from Cape Town to Durban by train, and we got on the boat at Durban, but it broke down. And so we were there for a month.
This is the John Ericsson boat?
No, no, we left the John Ericsson. We went then on a Greek boat called the Nihilas. We were, our draft, about 200, we were occupied the cabin space because the troop decks were full of West Africans that had come round from Lagos or Freetown.
From the Royal West African Frontier Force?
Yes.
And I think you said you arrived in Bombay about October?
Yes.
What, did you do much training in India?
Well, I was at the depot, the Royal Artillery Depot at Dealali, or Doolali as it's known, the forces. It's where you get the tap. And until I was on a draft, and then I was sent down to Bangalore to join the regiment, the 8th Field Regiment, which was in the 25th Indian Division.
And then?
We went on a scheme up in the jungles of Mysore with the 19th Indian Division, and that was over the Christmas in 43. And we came back from that.
What was the scheme like? What did it consist of as far as you were concerned?
Well, we were more or less fighting the 19th Division, if you can understand it. We were all right up in the jungle. It's jungle training.
What did you make of jungle training?
Well, I'm a country lad, you see, so I didn't mind it. It's the town people that couldn't stand the trees. I mean, I've been brought up in the woods.
So what specific advantages? Can you spell out the advantages that a country person would have for the jungle training?
Well, I'd been used to the dark, for one thing. I mean, the town people, until the war broke out, I mean, they'd never seen the dark, had they? They always had street lamps and things. And you see, you get all sorts of animal noises in the jungle, and they weren't used to those. I mean, we didn't... I mean, I'd heard animal noises before, slightly different, but it didn't worry me at all, not the jungle. It was the people that were in it when later on.
So the town people were rather nervous about being in the forest?
Yes, they didn't... I mean, they weren't used to it, that's the point.
Did they get used to it quickly?
Well, I think so, yes.
What about things like tracking and so on? Did that come into the training?
Well, we were dragging 25 pandas about, so we didn't do much of that.
What was your specific job with the artillery then?
Well, for the main part, I was a bombardier in a gun crew. Now, on a 25 pounder, there's a crew of six. The number one is the sergeant who's in charge. The number two, he opened and shut the breech and rammed the shell. Number three, he was usually a lance bombardier. He was the layer, sat on the seat and laid the gun. And number four loaded, actually put the shell into the breech and the cartridge, because it was separate ammunition. You had a shell and then a brass cartridge with the charge in. And number five, he was a sort of link between number four and number six. He was a man with no special job, as it were. He was a man that could be spared for odd jobs. Number six was the bombardier, and he was in charge of the ammunition to make sure that it was high explosive or smoke, whichever was called for, and there was the correct charge in the cartridge. Charge one, two or three. Took it from the limber to start with, and then we dispensed with the limbers because of the shortage of landing craft. We just used to take the guns. Sometimes we didn't even take a truck to pull them. We manhandled them off the barges and up the beach. But before that, they took all the seats out of the quads, as the gun tractors, and put boxes of ammunition in when we dispensed with the limbers. And the driver and the sergeants were the only ones that rode. Everybody else walked.
Was your job on the gun a popular one or an unpopular one?
Well, it was... I don't suppose it made much difference, really.
So you didn't have one job that was more sought after than the others?
Well, you didn't... look for a job. I mean, you promoted a sergeant or a bombardier, you dropped into that job. The bombardier did a lot of walking, because he always, when you moved, he always went forward to dig the gun pit. The sergeant and the layer always stayed with the gun in case they needed to fire with one or two gunners, and the bombardier went forward with one or two gunners to dig the gun pit ready for the gun to come up later on.
Was operating a 25 pounder in the East any different from operating it in Britain?
Well, the only thing was, you had roads in Britain, and we had to go along tracks or cut down trees to make roads. And of course, made a bit of difference on them, because the temperature of the charges made a difference to the range of the gun. We always carried a thermometer in our ammunition. It was actually our gun, which was in the middle of the troop, was the one that carried the thermometer. And of course, being with a big gun, you're always in the clearings. You couldn't be right in the jungle, because you had to get over the trees when you fired. And we had temperatures up to 115, 120 in the shade on the ammunition. And we were out in the sun.
Was the ammunition more dangerous to handle in the heat?
Don't think so, no.
But obviously harder work.
Well, it was a bit warm, you know.
How did the training exercise go in the Mysore forests? Was it all well organised or chaotic?
Well, very well, I think. The disorganised part came when we'd finished, actually, because the 19th Div went up country to do amphibious training, and we went into Burma and did all the landings.
How long were you doing the training for in India?
Well, I suppose it was over the Christmas, and about, we were up there about 2 or 3 months, I suppose, because we actually went in March 44.
What was the attitude of Indian people towards you? Did you have a good relationship with them or not?
Well, we never... They did say something about, where was it, one place near Bombay, was it Nasik? There's had a bit of trouble, but we never had any trouble. We didn't see much of them, really. We used to go down the bazaar, they used to try and twist us, of course.
Overcharging you?
Well, yeah, well, I mean, the point was, you see, you, if they offered you anything and they asked you a price, you always offered them half right away. And they'd come down a bit and you'd go up a bit, and in the end you'd walk away. And a lot of the time they'd come running after you with it and let you have it for the price that you decided. But when we came back to India afterwards, the Yanks had been there and it was all spoiled, because they always paid the price what was asked.
Did any of the Indians say to you that you British ought to go home?
No. We probably wouldn't have understood them if they did.
When did you go to after South India? After the Mysore area?
Well, we went back to Bangalore, which was a second-class hill station, actually. It wasn't bad there. And then we got kitted up a bit, and and then we moved off. And I was with the Rear Party then, and we went up to Calcutta by rail, and then got on a boat and went around to Chittagong.
What kind of reputation did the Japanese troops and army have in those days? Did they have a fearsome reputation?
Well, we always thought they were maniacs. Because, I mean, three of them would charge a company with bayonets and that sort of thing. I think it's something to do with their religion. But, of course, they were... Got a reputation for atrocities, using prisoners for bayonet practice and that sort of thing.
Were they feared by the British troops?
I don't think so.
Were Once you got to Chittagong, how did you then get into Burma? By what method of transport?
Well, we went on the railway down as far, I don't know what the name, the railhead, as far as the railway went. Because we hadn't got the guns in. I mean, I was with the rear party. They'd gone on before. I'd stayed behind to clear up the camp with others. And then we went by road up to Tong, I think it was Tong Bazaar. And then on a river steamer up to Mong Dor.
What was there at Mong Dor?
Well, it was a little river port. And the importance of Mong Dor was that the only road across the Mae Hoo Range went from Mong Dor through two tunnels into Boothydong. And that was the only road across to the other side of the Mae Hoo Range until the 7th Division had made the Nokidoke Pass.
And what did you do at Mong Dor?
Well, the division went into action there. We captured the second tunnel, the one nearest Boothydong. Oh, before we did that, I say we, of course, but we fired while the infantry went in, of course, on a hill 551, which was dominated the tunnel. We had to get rid of the Japs off that before we could get near the tunnel. Field Marshal Slim said the 26th Div captured it, but to my recollection, it was the 25th.
Whose memory do you think is the best?
Well, he wasn't there. He was then. You see, actually, the 15th Corps, which was down the Arakan, was separated from the 14th Army when the things really started. Field Marshal Slim was the 14th Army, and the 15th Corps was independent under Christiansen.
So, in this initial action, how many rounds do you think that your particular gun fired off?
I don't know, really.
Did you get word as to how accurate you'd be?
Well, in the initial action, I wasn't actually on the gun. It wasn't until I went on the gun later. I was with RHQ then, but I said I was a bombardier for the biggest part of my service, you see. I was with RHQ at that one, and I didn't actually go on the guns until we started to move after the monsoons.
Was there much Japanese artillery giving you incoming fire?
Well, not a lot. They had some 75s. And they used to get them up on a mountain and fire over open sites. They couldn't fire. I mean, we used to fire on a map reference. But they could only fire over open sites.
Why? Why was that?
Well, they'd only got these wooden-wheeled First World War guns there. It's the only ones we had there. Had some big mortars. The mortars were pretty accurate.
Did you capture any of their artillery pieces? Did you see any of them?
No. The only thing I saw captured, an Indian regiment brought in a 25-pounder, which had been captured at Singapore. But, of course, the gunners there had thrown the firing mix into the drink. And they used to fire. The Japs had got these 25-pounders, but they used to fire them with a hammer and a nail through the hole in the back of the breech and get the hand out of the way quick.
How dangerous was that?
Well, the piece came back a yard and you didn't see it come back.
So they must have suffered some casualties.
Yes, probably. But their ammunition was... the ammunition they had for the 25-pounders was only a... It was getting a bit old, I think, see, because they'd captured it at Singapore.
Where was this captured 25-pounder that you saw?
Oh, that was somewhere down the Arakan, getting down a bit.
How long after you'd got there, do you think?
Oh, this was about... we went in March. And then we didn't start her move . We sort of consolidated the position round Mong Dol Boothie Dong for the monsoon. The first monsoons we were in, nobody did anything much. But after the monsoon, we started off down the Mayu Peninsula. And with our guns, we went down the sand when the tide was out, because there's no roads, you see. The big chongs, the Indian engineers put a bridge across, but most of them were dried up, because that was one of the main troubles, you see. We never had any water after the monsoons. Too much while the monsoons were on, but once they'd finished, you'd never got any, you see, because if there was a river, it was salt, because we were down the sea coast. So the only wash we got was in the sea.
What were you rationed to per day?
When we were on airdrop, it was a lot of the time, it was a pint per person per day, and it all went to the cookhouse. So you had about a third of a mug of tea three times a day. So... there was one thing about that. When we were going down, the Navy used to come in with landing craft with rations and ammunition, and they'd call for volunteers to go and unload the barge. Well, the first time they never got any, but after that there was a great competition to get on the fatigue party, because when you'd finished unloading the barge, the Navy gave each man half a pint of water. And you nearly fought for that.
So that was about the best reward you could have.
Yeah.
Can you tell me how the troops coped with the monsoon conditions? What was it like living in the monsoon?
Well, the first one wasn't too bad. Because we were more or less